Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and fleet services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is part two of the Ryan Waller case with my friends over at Weird True Crime. So last week, I shared with you the episode of Ryan's story, and today's episode is going to be my conversation with them about Ryan's case and where things stand today. So this is not going to be like your typical episode because nothing about this is going to be scripted. It's all just conversational. But before you go, make sure you give Weird True Crime a follow wherever you stream your podcasts. And thank you so much for listening to and sharing Ryan's story. It is so important. So the first episode that you guys published about this story was so gripping, and I listened to it. I was hooked. I loved how you incorporated so much of the actual interrogation footage because I felt like it was so important to really see how this all went down. And it really begs the question, how does something like this happen? I just can't wrap my head around how nobody noticed that this poor victim was shot in the face and they just sat there for hours interrogating him. So we kind of left off, or you guys left off on that first episode, with, you know, the injuries that he was left with after the fact. But I really want to know if any of the police or detectives were ever held accountable. How is his family doing now? How is Heather's family? So you guys take it away and tell me what we need to know.
So no, nobody was ever held accountable for this. And while the interrogation video does show a lot of kind of what he was dealing with in that moment. And you can see how much he was struggling. And it's pretty obvious to anybody watching it, right? But that's like just the surface of how he was mistreated and everything that went on the night of the crime. And then all of the things that went wrong after the crime. So, and that's nothing that we got into in our first episode covering this, because we didn't know any of that at that point. And it wasn't until we actually reached out to Ryan's dad, Don, and interviewed him that he gave us all of this information that the public doesn't know about this case and what really happened, along with police statements, witness interviews, depositions, court documents, Heather's autopsy. There is so much information about this case that just makes it worse than it already seemed.
Which that itself is hard to imagine that this story could possibly get any worse. But I feel like that's why true crime podcasts really are so important in telling victim stories, because the media, of course, is not going to tell you all that nitty gritty stuff or the stuff that makes their own municipality look bad, right? So yeah, I think that's why it's so important for you guys to be digging for this information. I'm glad that you did, because I have seen this story on like a Dateline-esque show. I don't know if it was actually Dateline or something like it, but I remember seeing this story and then hearing your guys' episode kind of refreshed my memory, but it does seem to scrape the surface. And even just the surface, if the surface is this gnarly, then what else are we not aware of? And so, yeah, tell me what you guys have found. Tell me about your conversation with Don.
So I really just want to back up and talk about the events of that day, and because it's really the best way to understand kind of the breakdown and where it happened. So it's Christmas 2006. It's Ryan's first Christmas not living at home. He's an 18-year-old kid, had just moved out a couple months before to live with his childhood friend turned girlfriend, Heather Kwan. So they grew up together, knew each other their whole lives. And then, you know, it just kind of naturally turned into a relationship. And they had been dating about a year when they moved in together. And so Ryan was 18, Heather was 21. And it's Christmas Day. It's his first Christmas not at home. And he was expected to show up to his dad's house for Christmas dinner that day. And his dad, Don, had called him multiple times throughout the day, never answered the phone. Don was like, cool, maybe he's just sleeping or doing whatever. But then by the time Christmas dinner rolled around and Ryan still hadn't shown up and he still wasn't answering the phone, they start getting a little worried. And then dinner's over, still no word from Ryan. So Don and Julie, Ryan's mom, decide to go over there and see if they can get a hold of him or what's going on. So they drove over to his house about 7:50 p.m. on Christmas Eve or on Christmas Day, and there was still no answer, and they couldn't tell if anybody was there.
So when they couldn't figure out if anybody was there, they were getting no answer, they decided to call the police department to perform a welfare check. Now, it took around 3.5 to 4 hours for an officer to finally call them back, and then another like half an hour for them to arrive at the house. And so it's, you know, around midnight at this point. Apologies. So police are kind of, you know, circling the house, looking around, checking everything out, and they look through one of the windows and they see a body laying on the couch, not moving. But instead of, you know, forcing their way into the house to check on this person that's not moving, thinking, you know, that they could possibly need medical attention or something like that, they instead decided to call for a search warrant to enter the house that took like another hour for them to receive approval on that search warrant to enter the house.
Yeah, which is so, I don't understand. Don does not understand. If you look through the window and see somebody lying unresponsive on the couch and you've been knocking and yelling and trying to get somebody's attention, why would you not just force your way into, I don't understand why you need a search warrant.
Right. I mean, that's the purpose of the well check, is you go there, you make a lot of noise and ruckus and make sure they know that you're outside, you're yelling, you're pounding on the door. Any, you know, mentally competent person would respond to that. Even if they were asleep, it would wake them up. So,
right.
Yeah, that's definitely a lapse in judgment to Absolutely. Assume that, well, maybe they're asleep, so I'll just get a search warrant just to be safe.
I mean, it's one thing if they had been banging and banging and banging and saw no one, heard nothing. They're like, okay, mm-hmm. well, you know, they could probably conclude there's probably nobody home. But the fact that they literally saw a human being laying there and they're just like, ah, well, can't do anything about it yet.
Yeah, it's
never. I'll never understand it.
It's insane.
Yeah, that's definitely strike one.
Yeah. And so then, like Amber said, it took another hour for them to get this search warrant. So by this time, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. They've been there for hours just waiting for anybody to do anything. And so they finally get into the house. They had to have a locksmith come out to get into the house because the doors were locked. So they finally gain entry. And Don and Julie are still standing outside in the dark. And here comes Ryan in handcuffs, being led by officers, and he gets put in the back of a police car. They don't get to talk to him or anything. And Don was aggressively stopped by an officer when he tried to walk up to the car to check on him because, you know, he's like, oh, cool, my son's not dead, because he had been just standing there crying, afraid that his son was dead in this house. And he finally sees that his son is alive, but he gets put back in the back of this car. And then the cops refuse to let him talk to him and actually get very physical with him. So he tries to go to the car. The cop stops him and he's like, I just want to see if my son's okay, and tries to take another step forward. And the cop actually chest bumps him and threatens him, telling him, try it, like try to take another step forward, see what happens. And he's just trying to check on his kid. And he never got to talk to Ryan that night. He never got to talk to him.
And the thing was, even in the dark, how late it was at night, they could tell, like, Ryan had like dark bruising and swelling around like his left eye. And so, you know, that's why Dawn was trying to go over there to check on him. They could blatantly see that their son was injured. But instead of getting medical attention, he was put into the back of the police car and never saw EMS. So this poor kid, Ryan, sat in the back of this police car for almost 4 hours while detectives were, you know, going in and out of the house. Nobody ever came over to Don and Julie to give them any information about what they had found, what had happened, or anything that was going on. They essentially just told them, you just need to go home. We're going to be here for hours.
Yeah, like nobody's going to talk to you right now. Just go.
Despite his so obvious injuries, I mean, his eye is completely swollen shut. He's got what appears to be an obvious entry and exit wound on his nose, and then even more blood above his ear. I mean, why wouldn't that be their first thought, to at least make sure he gets checked out? I feel like that's common practice, that if somebody, even if they are a suspect, is injured, they get medical treatment before they get interrogated or whatever, or charged.
Exactly.
I mean, we see that all the time. So why not this time?
Why not?
Why not? That's the loaded question.
Yeah.
And so Don and Julie are forced to go home. Don said he just laid there in bed. Of course, not sleeping, right? And then the next morning, December 26th, around 7 o'clock in the morning, he gets a call from St. Joseph's Hospital informing him that Ryan was in the ICU in critical condition with a bullet in his brain. So this is brand new information to him, right?
Yeah, the last time he saw him, he was walking to a police car. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure in his mind, he's like, did the cops do this? Like, how did this happen?
Right. And yeah, this was the first time that Don learned that Ryan had been injured. And he's completely taken by surprise. And he gets to the hospital, and doctors tell him that the left side of Ryan's jaw is also broken, though it's not related to the gunshot wound, and the doctors don't know how it happened, but his jaw is broken. So not only does he have a bullet lodged in his brain, his jaw is broken.
Right. I saw that also, and that just broke my heart. I broke my jaw when I was a child, and to hear him talking in that interview or in that interrogation, knowing he had a broken jaw at the time too. Oh my gosh. It's devastating listening to that whole interrogation, knowing what his injuries were. Yep. Mm-hmm. And knowing that they keep pressing him and call, like, accusing him of lying. I mean, it's just, oh, it is so infuriating. You guys nailed it when you said you're going to listen to this episode and be pissed. And
yeah.
You're just
continuously.
Like, how do these guys, multiple people keep failing?
Mm-hmm. And once you learn more of the details about it and the steps that they took to cover their own tracks, it's just, it's unfathomable. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, why they
would do also, this. It makes sense as to why people have a lack of trust in law enforcement. It's these types of individuals that have these types of jobs and they're in this type of power. This is why there's so much distrust.
100%.
Back in the hospital, while in Ryan's room, an officer approached Dawn and asked about this girl, Heather, who was found dead inside the house. That question is how Dawn learned that Ryan's girlfriend, Heather, had been killed. The police never informed him directly.
Nope.
So Ryan needed life-saving brain surgery, but the doctors had to delay the procedure for 2 days due to a severe infection in his brain. They couldn't safely do anything because of the swelling and the infection. And to say the damage was extensive is it's an understatement. He lost most of his left frontal lobe and his eyesight in his left eye. That was the immediate issues.
Mm-hmm. And how can they say that? I know later on they say that it didn't matter the time that went by. It would have had no bearing on the injuries. It wouldn't have made them better or worse. But how can you argue that the infection wasn't caused by the time it took for them to actually get in there and figure this out? Like,
yeah, it gets worse. Like, you're like, okay, 6 hours is a long time. Of course, it's going to make a difference, but it gets worse. Like, the links, it's just, so Ryan had to have 5 brain surgeries, 5, and managed to pull through. And so after these surgeries, he's sitting there basically comatose, and Dawn's just hoping that there's going to be some sort of sign that he's going to be okay. And about 2 weeks after Ryan, Dawn told this really cute story about Ryan started trying to pull these compression cups off of his foot, because they put compression cups like on your legs to keep the blood circulation. And I guess one of them must have been irritating him. And so he started using his toe of one foot to like cup it around the other one to like pull it off his leg because it was irritating him. And so that was like the first sign of hope they really got that he may pull through this. And I just thought it was such like a human response. It's not like he woke up and looked around, right? He was like, oh, this thing on my foot is really bothering me, and just like is trying to get it off. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was a really sweet story. And I mean, the relief they must have felt in that moment, because you're 2 weeks in and you still have no idea if your son's going to pull through or not.
Yep.
Yeah.
That had to be so agonizing.
So at this point now, there have been no arrests made. And no one knew who was responsible for the attack, despite what Ryan had said in the interrogation. But Dawn feared that whoever it was that tried to kill Ryan would want to come back and possibly finish the job. I mean, I would have been terrified of that too. So they devised a way in order to keep Ryan safe while he was in the hospital. They hid him in the pediatrics wing under a code name of Guitar so that no one can find him. And if anybody came to the hospital asking to see Ryan, they were turned away. You had to, you know, I'm here to see Guitar. That's the only way that anybody could see Ryan.
And the code name was Guitar because he was a huge guitar player. Like, he had been playing his whole life. And so, yeah, Dawn said he was terrified to leave his bedside because he didn't know what was going to happen to him.
Yeah,
because,
of course.
He's a witness to a murder. They could want to come back and take him out so he can't, you know, testify against them. And he was in the hospital and rehab for over 40 days. He had to relearn how to walk and talk. And during this time, he didn't know that Heather had been killed. So he kept asking about how she was. And Don finally had to tell him that she had died. And he said it was heartbreaking having to sit here and tell him after he had already been through so much that his girlfriend had also died.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, not just his girlfriend, but like his childhood best friend. They'd, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was so much deeper than just a girlfriend. Yeah. Which is mm-hmm. just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And to add to that, during this time in the hospital, this 40 plus days he spent in the hospital, no one from the Phoenix Police Department ever contacted them. Nobody ever asked how Ryan was. Nobody ever questioned Don and Julie to see who might want to hurt Ryan or what Ryan's life was like or what he was involved in or anything. They were never questioned. Never. Nobody ever talked to them this entire time.
You know, the typical things that you would, you know, expect a police department to conduct interviews to find out what really happened.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. 40 plus days, like a month and a half, and nobody came to talk to them.
As soon as Don had arrived at the hospital on December 26th, Ryan told him exactly who was responsible, exactly who had shot him, Larry and Richie Carver. So basically from day one, he had been saying it. But and the Carvers, they weren't exactly strangers to law enforcement They weren't exactly strangers to Ryan. Richie had lived in the house that Ryan moved into before Ryan moved in. Like, so there was no overlapping. They were never roommates. They were never there together, but there mm-hmm. was that connection. Because there are some reports that say that they had been roommates, but, you know, Don clarified that they never did live together. Richie moved out right before Ryan moved in.
So was this just a random burglary attempt? Like they kind of knew the layout of the apartment because he had lived there prior, or was there a motive?
I mean, they were bad dudes. Like they had extensive criminal records. They both mm-hmm. did. And Don had mentioned that Richie, I think, had come to get mail or something when Ryan was moving in, and Ryan had a very extensive guitar collection and Richie was eyeing that. Mm-hmm. And he had been spotted snooping around the property previously. Like Ryan caught him one night in the backyard, and Richie said that he was looking for his pet iguana, but he was like clearly casing the house mm-hmm. because he wanted to break in and steal stuff. So yeah, but that's
not good dudes.
No, but that's literally the only connection they had. And Heather mm-hmm. didn't know him at all. She had never met either one of them.
And they did have a roommate, right? Alicia?
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw some conflicting reports about when she was there, if she was there, like, and how that all kind of fell into place. Can you explain that?
So it's a complicated, crazy story. So Don and Julie got there, knocked on the door, waited the 3.5-4 hours for them to come do the welfare check, right? So during mm-hmm. that time, they went straight down the road to a Circle K that you could see from Ryan's house to get coffee. So they were gone for 15 minutes tops. Well, during that time, Alicia came home and came inside, but it was dark inside, and she talked to Ryan and saw that he had bruising, but because it was so dark, she couldn't tell that it was as bad as it was. And she was mm-hmm. like, "What happened to your face?" And he was like, "Oh, there was an issue, like, but I dealt with it. It's fine. Like, don't worry about it." And she's like, "Katie, cool." She never saw Heather, so she didn't know that anything was really going on, and she just went to her room and shut the door. And then when the cops finally did come to do the welfare check and knocked on the door, she thought that Ryan answered the door because they stopped. So when they got into the house, she was like, "Oh, like, what the hell?" And then came out and talked to them. But Dawn said that she lived with the guilt for so long that she came home and didn't realize that anything was going on, didn't answer the door. I just, that poor girl, because you know, people probably looked at her like, "What the hell? Like, Mm-hmm. Why didn't you do anything? And she's like, I just came home and didn't realize that anything really was going on and went to my room. And who knows how close they even were. It could have been one of those situations where she was just renting the extra room in the house and they weren't really friendly or anything. So it's like, I just had a brief conversation with him and went to my room.
Right. And it's late, it's dark. And mm-hmm. it reminds me a lot of the Koberger situation, the Idaho 4 with those yep. roommates that were in the house. And I covered that case extensively too. And I read through the affidavit word by word for the podcast. And it brought me to tears. I was like nearly sobbing during that episode because I just could not fathom what those poor girls went through. Yep. That's the thing. Like, you don't know until you know. Hindsight is 20/20. It's a cliche yep. saying for a reason. The things mm-hmm. that seem so obvious aren't always that obvious as you're going through them. And your brain often tries to protect you from danger. So it'll convince you that something else is happening that's not really happening, right? So of course, her mind's not going to go to, oh, his eye might be bruised because we had intruders and my friend's dead on the couch. Like, that's not exactly always where somebody's mind goes. But no. people lose that sense of grace, especially if they have not been through it or if they're not into true crime and they are not familiar with these stories. So that's a disappointing mm-hmm. human response from other people listening that
it's yeah, it's that really they judge easy her. To it's really easy to judge a situation that you have never been in.
Right.
Yourself. Exactly. Because like you said, it's not somebody's first thought to be like, oh, something awful has happened here. You're just like, mm-hmm. oh, well, that's weird. Okay. Like,
you know, yeah. and she doesn't realize the extent of the damage. She's like, okay, well, I mean, if something really serious would have happened, then, you know, Ryan would have taken care of it. Ryan wouldn't just be here like, oh, no, it's fine. It's you know, it's all taken care of. It's a completely understandable reaction to mm-hmm. have if, you know, he's just like, no, it's fine. I took care of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, oh, buddy, no, cool. no more questions then, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she doesn't exactly. realize that he's having that response because he has this traumatic brain injury and doesn't really know what's going on.
Yep. Right.
There's no way to know.
No.
No, I take that back. There is a way to know because the cops should have known. But again, middle of the night, dark. It was, you know, day after Christmas or, you know, the night after Christmas, essentially. Like, there's just.
We trust that police officers are trained to handle situations like this that someone else might not be prepared for. They're specially trained to look for those types of clues, especially when they're sitting in a brightly lit interrogation room with the person right in front of you. And you can see the extent, you can understand their questions or their answers don't make any sense. And that they're agonizing, like groaning and moaning in pain. Like, mm-hmm. so
exactly.
yeah, I see how someone might twist that, but
yeah. And they took over 40 pictures of him before they stuck him into the interrogation room, like up close pictures where you can obviously see entry and exit wounds on his face. And this was before they stuck him in the room and interrogated him for an hour.
Yep. That is so crazy to think of how many like people saw his injuries. So how many professionals saw it, took pictures of it. And yet nobody in the entire department said, we should probably get him checked out and then resume interrogating. But it's like, they overlook that to get their interrogation in before a lawyer gets involved or whatever. And it's like, yep. so frustrating.
Okay. So going back, you know, the police hadn't reached out to see how Ryan was doing whenever he was in the hospital. So when Ryan was actually able to return home in early February, this was, you know, over 40 days after the shooting. That's finally when a police officer comes to the house to interview Ryan and talk to the Wallers. And in, you know, talking to the police, he said the same thing that he had been saying that he'd been telling his dad the entire time. Richie and Larry Carver shot him and killed Heather. His story never changed. He was saying the same information. But, you know, Ryan was suspect number one from day one. And the Wallers, they were not aware of that. They were not aware that the police were treating their son as the prime suspect in what had happened. The lead detective, Paul Dalton, had been pushing the theory that this had been a murder-suicide gone wrong, that Ryan had killed Heather and then tried to kill himself and failed. And that's what they walked in and found.
Yeah, because who doesn't just like point a gun right at their own nose right. if they're trying to commit suicide? Like, there's so mm-hmm. many flaws.
Mm-hmm. And Don only learned this when this officer came to their house and casually mentioned that the police had spent a day and a half tearing Ryan's house apart looking for a murder weapon. They destroyed all of the furniture, like left the couch, chairs, anything with like fabric upholstery in shreds. There was stuffing all over the house. They even searched the insulation in the attic for a day and a half looking for a gun. And they never found one. Of course, like Ryan only had an antique gun from his grandfather, which he never used. It was kept like packed up in the back of a closet somewhere.
More like a memento.
Yeah. Like my brother has one of my grandfather's old guns. Like I feel like that's, you know, that's pretty common in certain areas. But Don shared with us that this interview was recorded. So the interview that was done at his house was recorded. But when they received a copy of it later for the lawsuit, the mention of the murder-suicide theory and the destruction of the house looking for the gun had been cut out of it. No longer existed.
So that's the first clue that they're definitely trying to cover their asses. And did they ever interrogate or interview Richie and Larry, or like just to even check out the alibi or whatever they thought that Ryan was trying to give? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, if they were really doing their job, which obviously they're not, but if they really were, don't you think they would have at least sought that out even a little bit? Did they ever?
So the police actually raided the Carver residence and arrested Richie Carver at the beginning of February 2007. So Larry
Carver. 2 months later.
Yeah. Larry Carver actually fled to California, and he was still in California when Richie was arrested. So yeah, they finally did something. But so around this time, there's a few other key events that happened. Heather's initial autopsy report listed Heather's date of death as December 25th and stated she died sometime between 5 and 8 p.m. on Christmas Day. About a month and a half later, like early February, the date was changed to December 23rd. The reason that they gave for this was that the rigor mortis in Heather's body was breakable, which doesn't occur until 48 hours after a person's death. So Heather's family didn't agree with this change of date for a very, very, very important reason. Heather's best friend, Christina, spent time with Heather on Christmas Eve, December 24th.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in a recorded interview talking about how they went to the mall, they ate cookies, and then took a nap at Heather's parents' house. So there's literally no way this could have happened if Heather was killed on the 23rd. And Heather's gravestone still lists her date of death as December 25th, 2006.
Why did they want to change it? What would they benefit from that?
If they changed the date of death, that would put more time from Ryan's injury to when the police got involved. So their measly little 6 hours delay of not getting him medical care, that wouldn't have mattered.
Gotcha. So they're trying even more to pin it on Ryan, even after realizing Ryan didn't do it. So they're doubling down on this theory. That's sick.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to remove any wrongdoing that they had handling the investigation from themselves in any way they possibly can.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's not the only date that was changed either. It's not the only time the date was changed, because after Richie was arrested and Larry was still in California because he fled to California, Cheryl Carver, Larry's wife and Richie's mom, went to the police with more information about Larry's involvement, because Richie had already been arrested. And so she's trying to, like, you know, stick up for her son a little bit. So she did provide a lot of critical information that was correct. So, but there was one thing that was bizarre. She said the crime occurred on the 23rd between 8 and 9 p.m. And this is in her written statement. We have seen it. Like, we have the documentation And it goes on to read that Larry came home that night and told Cheryl that he had to get out of there because he killed two people. And he told her to get rid of the bullets that matched the gun he used. And he took off to California the same night. But Cheryl's statement said Larry was back by Christmas morning and the family all had brunch together. And I mean, think about it, right? So the date on Heather's autopsy report changed right around the same time. And according to the Waller's investigators that helped them with the lawsuit against the police department, they believe that Cheryl was manipulated mm-hmm. by the police department to change the date so it could match this revised autopsy report and their story that the shooting happened on the 23rd and not the 25th, because they were trying to deflect blame from the department for failing to get Ryan medical help.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was literally going to say that once you said that she wrote the date, I was like, well, I wouldn't put it past the cops to influence that in her mind if she, you know, misremembered according to the cops.
Mm-hmm. And the date used during the trial was also the 23rd. Even though in all of the appeals documents, everything lists the 23rd, even though there's witness testimony showing that Heather was with a friend on the 24th and Ryan, you know, the guy who got shot in the head and survived, is saying it happened on Christmas.
Larry and Richie were arrested February 2007. And the trial didn't begin until the summer of 2008. So Richie and Larry were both tried together for first-degree murder, burglary, aggravated assault, and weapons misconduct. And I think, as you know, we mentioned earlier, they had an extensive criminal record. Richie had spent 4 years in prison after stabbing someone in an attempted burglary of a vehicle when he was just 17 years old. So unfortunately, the murder weapon was never found, but there was witness testimony and Richie's ties to the house that linked him to the scene.
Yeah, and Cheryl was supposed to testify with her statement, but when it was time to take the stand, she said that she did not remember making those statements, and or that she lied to the detectives because her relationship with Larry was rocky and she wanted to be rid of him. She was scared. That's all it comes down to. She was scared that Larry was going to kill her if she testified against him. And Don even said that. Like, we talked about this. He said, I can't fault her for doing that because she was terrified for her life because she had already been abused for years by this man and didn't know what he would do if she had gotten up there and testified against him. So he's like, I can't fault her. I'm not mad at her for that, which is so big of him.
I know.
He is such, like, he's just such an empathetic, like, understanding human. I don't know that I would have felt the same way in that situation, but you do understand why she did it, but it still sucks. And because of that, Larry was acquitted because Cheryl invoked her spousal testimonial privilege and refused to testify. And the prosecution didn't feel they had a strong enough case without the testimony. So he was acquitted.
During the trial, the defense played Ryan's interrogation video to the jury. This was the first time Don had learned his son had been interrogated after spending 4+ hours in the back of a police car. A year and a half later, he had no idea that had happened until a year and a half later when that video was played right then. In the footage, it shows Ryan visibly injured, confused. He's slurring his words. He's struggling to answer basic questions. Like, at the very beginning, before the interrogation even starts, there's a piece of paper sitting on the table, and there's you know, like a bar on the table to where they handcuff, where they'll handcuff a suspect to the table. Ryan handcuffed himself. He sat down there. Nobody's in the room. He picked it up and he handcuffed himself. And then a little time goes by and he picks up this paper and he's looking at it intently. Like he's reading a whole bunch of stuff on this paper. And a few moments later, like he's, you know, he puts the paper down, he's getting visibly uncomfortable and he tries to stand up and walk, but he had handcuffed himself and he can't. And so, you know, you see him look back, like, where did this come from? What happened? And come to find out that paper that he had been extensively reading and studying, it was a blank sheet of paper. Yeah. There was nothing on there. So there's clearly so much going on with him during that.
You know, can you imagine watching video of your child? Because like, no matter how old they are, they're always going to be your baby, right? Your child. I cannot always. Imagine the rage I would feel watching that. And just the desperation knowing that you can't go back and help him in that moment. But also, it also kind of prompted this thought in my head, like, even if their theory was that it was a murder suicide or a murder attempted suicide, so you know he's hurt then. So like you saying that and alleging that means you know he has suffered an injury. So you are aware he is injured, but you're choosing not to give him medical treatment. Like even, man, yeah, that's.
You can't talk your way out of it. Right? No. You can't. And Don did say that he was so upset when he realized that Ryan had been interrogated because he didn't know that, right? So when he got to the hospital the morning after, when he found out that he was in the ICU, he had done an interview with local media outside of the hospital, just like about what happened. And so he's sitting there talking to them, right? Thinking that he went from the back of the cop car to the hospital. He said if he had known that Ryan had been questioned for an hour, treated like a suspect, photographed, all this other stuff, he would have been livid. Like he said, I would have not been in the same mood that I was in.
Yeah.
In that interview. Just imagine a year and a half goes by and you had no idea that this happened to your kid. And the most frustrating part about it is, for those of us who have seen the video, Ryan does name Richie and Larry Carver during the interrogation. At first he said they shot him with bows and arrows, but then he said they used revolvers. But he clearly stated that he was shot and that Larry and Richie were responsible. And despite this, the detective still focused on him as a suspect even after they finally got him medical care. So he said in that interrogation video that night or that early morning, Larry and Richie Carver shot me, but they continued to look at him as the main suspect for the next 40 plus days while he was struggling to survive in the hospital.
Yeah, that's why when I asked earlier if they ever vetted that to confirm or corroborate his alibi, it took so much longer for them to finally take that tip seriously. And yet they were going to take anything else he said seriously. If he would have admitted that he did it, they would have been like, okay, yeah, he's telling the truth. We got him.
Because that's what they want.
It's very manipulative.
Yeah,
they had blinders on. They thought, you know, this is an open and shut case. This is what happened. We've got our man. Let's nail him and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Don said all they would have had to do was go look at like utility bills and stuff for the house to see that Richie's name had been in the house. Like he's clearly tied to the house. It would have taken a day for them to figure it out, but they didn't even try because they were so set on convicting Ryan.
No, and at that point, they just would have made an excuse like, oh, well, then that's why he's naming them because he's seen his name on a piece of mail. So that's why he's trying to accuse this other guy. I mean, I'm sure it wouldn't have mattered. No. Any truth that would have come their way would not have mattered because people who are just that hell-bent on being ignorant, you can face them with so much truth and they're still going to believe what they want to believe because it fits their own narrative, their own agenda.
And at that point, you know, they're already in the hole, right? They've already screwed up. So you can't admit to that. You just have to double down.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Just keep doubling and doubling and doubling down.
So yeah, because of the mental state that Ryan was in that video, the defense used it to discredit his memory and argue that his confusion made his testimony unreliable. Like he didn't know what was going on. So you can't believe anything he says.
Despite that, Richie was convicted and sentenced to life without parole. However, as mentioned, Larry had been acquitted due to his wife refusing to testify. This was just absolutely devastating for Heather and Ryan's families. Heather's family helped pass Heather's Law, which changed spousal privilege laws in Arizona, that basically a person could be forced to testify against their spouse in a criminal trial. Larry was rearrested after this law was passed, but his defense argued the law couldn't be enforced retroactively. So he was released.
Oh my God.
Yet again. Heather's parents were not going to give up. They appealed to the judge's decision, and they won.
Larry was rearrested for a third time and finally convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole in 2013. But to put it in perspective, he was free for 6 years, roaming around, not on parole, not being watched, nothing, living his life in the same community as his victims, while they just fought to get him behind bars.
I can't even imagine. Did he commit any other crimes in the meantime? Because I think that's interesting.
Probably. I didn't see anything specific on the pages and pages and pages of police records. I wouldn't be surprised if he did. If anything, I'm sure he wasn't great to Cheryl during that time.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say too, like my mind went there also. Like, I wonder if Cheryl regretted, because then him being acquitted just puts him right back in her house. So
absolutely.
But getting the Carvers behind bars, that wasn't the only thing the Wallers were working toward during this time. Because of everything that had happened, they had spent almost 4 years building a case against the Phoenix Police Department, and they ended up suing them for $15 million for how badly they mishandled Ryan's case. During discovery, the Wallers found a police report from the night of the crime. Going back a little bit, Ryan had been thrown to the ground when he didn't put his hands up. And it pinned his arms beneath him. The officer used a pressure point technique on his left jaw to get his arms out from under him. This aligned with the fracture on the left side of Ryan's jaw. So the cops were responsible for breaking Ryan's jaw. I mean, he's pinned down to the ground with his arms under him. You know, if you've got the weight of another human on top of you, it's not exactly the easiest thing in the world to get your arms released. And so instead of taking a moment to assess the situation or do anything, they implement this pressure point on his jaw and break it.
The report says that they gently lowered him to the ground, and then he wiggled his arms under himself. That's what the report says. Don's like, no. They threw him to the ground. And the only way that something like that breaks a person's jaw is if, like, they're not actively fighting, which I highly doubt he was fighting them, right? Like, he wasn't in his right mind. He has no idea what's going on. He's probably like, cool, my arms, I just got pinned to the ground. What's going on? And so instead of, like, giving him a minute, they just immediately, you know, do this pressure point on him and break his freaking jaw.
And then he's got to go talk to them for a few hours after that.
Their lawsuit, like we said, argued that delaying medical care caused irreversible damage and included testimony from a renowned brain surgeon, wound specialists, and more. And their expert testimony from this brain surgeon stated that every minute without care made a difference.
Yeah, I don't need to be a brain surgeon or a neurologist to come to that conclusion, but I'm glad that they had that expert witness to confirm that.
And the fact that they had to spend a lot of money for that expert witness to say something that's very, you know,
common sense.
Yeah.
You ready to get angry yet again?
I don't know.
The lawsuit was dismissed just 3 weeks before the trial.
Why?
A state witness claimed the six-hour delay in care didn't affect Ryan's condition.
A state's witness versus an actual neurologist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, state's witness.
I think it was a brain surgeon, but it was like
Somebody on their payroll. By manipulating the evidence to make it look like the crime took place on the 23rd, they argued that a few more hours wouldn't have made a big difference. And to add to that, the judge overseeing the case was set to retire in a couple of months. Don believes that the judge was bribed to dismiss the case so it would never see a courtroom. The judge is set to retire in a couple of months. What does he, you know, what does he have to lose?
Yeah, he's got senioritis. He's ready to get out.
Right. It's like, sure, I'll take some money under the table to like make this go away for you. And they could have appealed, but they had already spent so much money during this 4-year time period that their attorney said it was a lost cause. Because even if they won the appeal, if they lost in court, which they probably would have, because Phoenix PD was going to do anything they could to cover their tracks, the Wallers would have been responsible for paying all of those legal fees. And it's just not, it's not feasible.
No. Yeah. No. Especially when you're working up against the powers of a whole city establishment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's terrifying. And that's, we see miscarriages of justice like this a lot. Yeah. We see it all the time when they all work together and they're all kind of colluding together. And like, how are you supposed to, how is any average civilian with a normal paycheck, an average paycheck, supposed to fight against that? Not only does it take stamina, but it takes these high-level attorneys that cost a lot of money. I mean, people don't think about those things, I think, when you just kind of broadly talk about true crime, but just the actual extent of like what it puts these families through to fight for justice. At some point, yeah, you do just feel like you got to wave the white flag and say you did the best you could. But you know what you're up against and you're just realistic.
Paul Dalton, the investigator who questioned Ryan and denied him medical care, he was investigated but never found responsible for any wrongdoing. And he continued to work for the Phoenix PD until he retired and then went on to teach detective techniques at a local college.
That's like Casey Anthony being hired as a daycare provider. Are the other officers that are involved in this case, are they all still there also?
That's a good question. I don't know, because Dalton was taken off the case pretty quickly. So by the time Ryan got out of the hospital and the officer came to interview him, Dalton had been taken off the case. And they said it was because like something came up or some family thing, but it was 100% because of what he did. And they were like, oh, we're just going to take you away from this and put somebody else.
Yeah, because then it makes them look bad. It makes them look incompetent if they admit that they had hired somebody expected to do this job that they did wrong, you know?
Ryan was left permanently altered. Mm-hmm. He had memory issues. He had constant seizures and brain damage from the injuries. And it really, really made his daily life a struggle. The seizures that he experienced caused frequent injuries. Like he bit off part of his tongue. He broke his ankle. He had a seizure in a grocery store that left him needing 40 stitches.
To his face. Yeah. In his head. Yeah.
Is that the one that ultimately took his life?
The one in the grocery store only happens about a month and a half before he died.
It was very, it was very soon before.
Mm-hmm. And he also had daily seizures called drop seizures, where he would just kind of like go still. And that happened every day. He had lots of anger issues and everything because you're missing your frontal lobe, which is what helps you regulate all of that, right? Mm-hmm. And because of the broken jaw, he had debilitating TMJ that made it so difficult for him to eat. He couldn't open his mouth more than half an inch. So all of his food had to be cut into tiny little pieces. And he lived like this for 9 years.
Even his quality of life.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
He couldn't work. He couldn't drive a car. He couldn't have any sort of normal life. He had to move back in with his dad.
His parents. Yeah.
Yeah. And then his parents have to take care of him. I mean, that's not something they ever expected to do. They probably thought they got to retire and ride off into the sunset. But instead, they had to take care of their son, who was brutalized and mistreated by police until he ultimately died from those injuries. I mean, that's really sad.
Mm-hmm. And Don said you couldn't look at him without seeing the injuries. Like, he still had scars from where the bullet wound was, you know, all the scars on his face from the surgery. And he knew that he wasn't going to live a long life. He just knew.
So what ended up happening after he passed? Or was it revealed exactly how he passed? It was a result of a seizure?
So he had a seizure and passed away on January 20th, 2016. But it was a direct result of the shooting and the negligence, honestly, because, you know, it did make a difference. If he had gotten the care he needed immediately, he probably wouldn't have had such extensive damage because he wouldn't have had to sit there for days. But unfortunately, I mean, nothing happened as far as any sort of like justice or accountability. Nothing's ever been done.
This is where we're at. This is why.
So that's where it ends.
Yeah, that's where it ends. That's why we keep telling the story. That's why, like, Ryan's story will live with me for the rest of my life. I will never forget him.
Some stories just do, you know, and that this definitely is one worthy of that. I mean, they're all really, truly worthy of that. But this is just so problematic on so many levels. And yeah, more people need to be aware of stories like this, his story and stories like it, because
absolutely.
I mean, this is obviously an extreme case of like what the negligence can amount to when it comes to police being incompetent. And I'm not saying all police are. I have friends. I was actually named after a police officer who was shot and killed in the line of duty. So I have a lot of respect for police officers. But I still, because I am named after one, I think it makes me even more apt to hold them accountable and say, like, don't you dare give police a bad name. Like,
exactly.
The ones that do are the ones that deserve to be called out and held accountable and removed from that position.
Yep.
Because they make all the other actual good ones look bad. I mean, it creates this mistrust across the board. I had somebody leave a review once that said ACAB, and I didn't know what that meant. So I had to look it up. And it's apparently like a trendy hashtag that means all cops are bastards. These kinds of stories are why hashtags like that exist. Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating. And so it's even more frustrating when you realize that and you know that they all sometimes work together to protect the ones that really need to be weeded out. So that's very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Phoenix Police Department.
The Phoenix Police Department. And actually, about 2.5 years ago, maybe 3 years now, the Department of Justice, the DOJ, sent two people to Don's house to talk to him about the mishandling of Ryan's case because they were investigating the Phoenix Police Department. And there actually was a report released about problems with the Phoenix Police Department, but Ryan was never named. Never named.
How could he not be in his case is the biggest problem that they have.
And this is the issue with this case, right? Is because it's like, oh, well, he's passed away. Heather passed away. It's over. It's done.
It's done.
It's not. Because
it's not.
No accountability has been given. Like, nobody's come to say, we're sorry for how we handle it. And Don's not willing to give up. Like, he wants this to see a courtroom. He wants a jury to hear this case and make a decision about what should happen. I don't care about the money. I don't care. You know, I just want them to be held accountable for what happened to my son. That's all he wants. And which is why we're trying to spread more awareness about what really happened.
Something has to be done. I don't know what that looks like. What is his goal? I mean, other than just making sure that they are held accountable. Is it to see some of these people be removed from that position so this doesn't happen again? Or does he want to go even further than that and have laws put in place? Or do you know what his, you know, goals are?
I think the immediate goal is just to have somebody admit that they were wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of just trying to make excuses, cover things up, just admit there were mistakes that were made.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's hoping
own up to it.
Yeah. And he's hoping that media attention and people continuing to talk about it and bring new awareness will help put that necessary pressure on the Phoenix Police Department to actually do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think us as like content creators, but also our listeners, what they can do is share this story, not to benefit us as the creators, it's to benefit Ryan and his family.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other people that this could potentially happen to, because it doesn't sound like it's never going to happen again.
Oh, no.
It very much could happen again. I also want to say, when I Google Ryan Waller, you guys are one of the first things to pop up. So that's awesome. You guys are synonymous with Ryan Waller. So I feel like that's very important that you guys are sharing the truth about this story. And it's not some mainstream media outlet that's covering the story that's popping up first. So I just wanted to let you guys know. I didn't know if you knew that, but you probably did, but I just noticed it when I was looking it up earlier. I was like, oh my gosh, they're the first ones that pop up. That's awesome.
Well, the interrogation video, when that was released, that went viral, but that was the extent of it. Like, everybody just talks about, you know, the interrogation video. How crazy is it that this poor kid who got shot in the face, and that's it though. There's no continuation. There's no more information about what actually happened and the deep dive that we've done.
And I'm really glad that we were able to give him that.
Yeah, me too. You know, as I'm sure you guys can understand, but as content creators in the true crime space, we do kind of catch, I think, probably the most flack, aside from probably like political podcasts, but like we catch a lot of flack for being exploitative or, you know, using people's worst day of their lives for X, Y, and Z. You know, people assume that. And that is like one of the most insulting things somebody can say to me as a true crime podcaster. But it's like stories like this are why we do it. And exactly. Not everybody remembers that or realizes that. But like, you guys are giving this man a voice. You're giving Ryan a voice when their voices kept getting silenced by every detective, these state witness doctors, these judges. I mean, everything that is built and in place to protect you and your rights and your freedoms has let him down every step of the way. You guys might be his only chance to get some sort of justice or closure out of this whole event. And so I applaud you guys for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, thank you guys very much for allowing me to be a part of this, even in a little way. I mean, you guys have done all the heavy lifting, but I appreciate you telling me this story.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate you letting us share it some more.
Well, that concludes part two of the Ryan Waller case with my friends over at Weird True Crime. Make sure you go give them a follow wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, follow them on social media as they continue to share Ryan's story. They have some exclusive episodes, some conversations with Ryan's dad. So make sure you go give them a follow. Thank you so much for listening to this story, and we'll catch you next week. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.